So this is the fourth and final day of this four-day retreat here at the Franciscan Center in Tampa. We have been retreating from our normal activities of life so we could look more deeply in how to go about seeing life with clarity of intelligence, clarity and intelligence, and to see life with clarity and intelligence is the path of Dharma. There is a reason we do these practices and we do this study. It is not to become a scholar. It is not to become conversant in Buddhist ideas and thoughts, so we could have scintillating conversations with other people and show off how much we know. We are doing these various practices and we are studying Buddha Dharma so we can see life with clarity and intelligence. If you have practiced many years, you know, practice. If you've done the practices for many years, but in your daily life, you do not see with clarity intelligence, there is something wrong. Because the path of Dharma leads to clarity and intelligence. Okay. The reason we constantly, even after we've been practicing 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, or 40 years, we constantly review these profound and meaningful teachings is to make sure that we are practicing correctly. When you read Buddha Dharma, when you read the teachings, if you do not understand them, and I don't mean just intellectually, if you understand them, then you are living them. Because that's what understanding implies. If you are not living them, then you are not understanding Dharma and you are not practicing Dharma. Okay? And I'm speaking to myself now. Because if you are sincerely practicing Dharma, then you are seeing with clarity intelligence, and then you are leading a life from which everything flows from that. That is the path of Dharma. So it is important that we not water down Dharma to fit our low expectations, but that we understand that this path is about providing to us healing transformation, which is a more modern way of saying it, but it really means the cessation of suffering. That's a traditional way. And the cessation of suffering will only come about when ignorance of the way things are is clearly uprooted, seen into, and that the Eightfold Path is embraced. So please understand, and that is why throughout this retreat, as we reflected on impermanence, as we reflected on dukkha and suffering and the causes of suffering, as we've looked at the real understanding that the operating principle of how things move in this life is based on cause and effect, the law of karma. I've constantly encouraged us to look into all areas of your life and to make sure that there is nothing overlooked, that you are letting the light of Dharma, the clarity of Dharma, to come into all those places where you are confused, where there is still darkness, where you still live in emotional affliction. You know, the only reason you're doing that is because you are not living a life of clarity and intelligence, and the only reason you're not living a life of clarity and intelligence is because you're not practicing Dharma. There is no other reason. We are practicing the path of ignorance, right? And we know the path of ignorance implies that we that when we see the impure, we think it's pure. When we see the impermanent, we think it's permanent. When we see the things that are composited, we see it's solid, etc. Right? When we see things happening, we think the cause of it is out there. As long as we think that way, that thinking is based on ignorance. Ignorance is the fundamental movement of karma. If your fundamental view is based on ignorance, meaning ignorance of the way things really are, then things will unfold accordingly. All your actions will be tainted with ignorance, and actions that are tainted by ignorance, based on ignorance, in other words, confusion, delusion, misperception, will all, to one degree or another, end up in causing affliction. And that's the truth. On the other hand, if the fundamental operating principle of your life is right view, that you are seeing clearly, that you have the correct perspective on phenomena, on life, both internal and external, then you will find the opposite unfolds. You will find that goodness arises in your life and relationships, that happiness and a state of well-being and ease will be your mind state, and that your heart will be light and free. And that is the choice. Again, as you have heard over these past days, right view is not that hard to understand if one's willing to study it and concentrate on it, and really use one's intelligence to understand these views, and then if one then digests them by really reflecting deeply on them in the context of one's life and one's situations, and sees these are true operating principles, that this is the right perspective, not because it's the truth of the Buddha or the truth of Fred or the truth of anybody outside yourself, because when you have looked deeply into these principles of your own life, you have seen what your view is and where that one leads and where right view leads. And when you see that, you have now established a basis for really transforming your life. If you don't see it, please work on it. So before we move into post-retreat experience, post-retreat practice, is there anything up to now that has been shared with you over these past 4 days that is not clear? Or that you take, you have an alternative view? Please don't be shy. If anything is not clear, because it is important that we understand where we're going, and we understand how to get there, and we, that we understand the map, and we understand the guidebook, then we can walk in confidence. This morning, some people, you heard them, they took refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And you heard various expressions of what that means. Most of us, we take refuge in our ego. We take refuge in our misperceptions. We take refuge in wrong views. We take refuge in our emotional afflictions. We take refuge in our wounds and hurts and resentments. We take refuge in our fears. We take refuge in our losses. Because that is the true place that we go to refuge. Because a refuge, if you are taking refuge somewhere, you have to spend time there. And if you're spending time in all your emotional afflictions, and if you're spending your time in meaningless activities, that is the cause of your effects, of how your life will be. On the other hand, if you are really taking refuge in Buddha Dharma and Sangha, you know, that is where you're hanging out. Even if you're at work, even if you're you know, with your family, no matter what you're doing, because no matter where you are, right view is always to be cultivated. Because wherever you are, mindfulness is to be practiced. Wherever you are, open-heartedness and kindness is to be practiced. So taking refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha, as was said this morning, is found everywhere. But if you go through your day taking refuge in your own narrowness and pettiness and short-sightedness and egocentricity, you are not taking refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha. Even if you've taken the vows, even if you wear the brown jacket or the robes, because this is a practice not of externals. This is a practice of the heart-mind. And when it really enters the heart-mind, it will then be expressed, obviously, through the actions of one's speech and one's body. No matter what kind of clothes you wear, no matter what color the robe you put on. Is there anything not clear about that? Yes.
What's not clear for me is that, what is clear for me is that I follow the perfection road frequently. I follow the practice road from time to time and lay seeds of karma that are not what I might wish them to be. Mm-hmm. And what are your instructions about getting back on track?
Again, the interesting thing is, as soon as you realize that, you are back on track. Right? As soon as you realize that, you're back on track. Right? As soon as you, you know, if your object is to be mindful of your breath, and as soon as you realize you're lost in a thought, you are mindful. You're, at that moment, you are mindful. Right? And then all you need to do, come back on track. You know, what we need to do is see that even all our missteps are impermanent. It's not solid. There's nothing there. So they can be let go of immediately when they are seen. You know, no recrimination, no guilt. You know, you hear me say many times, you know, in Buddhism we talk about, you know, you're already shot with one arrow. Why do you keep shooting more arrows in there? You know what I mean? Like you've already gotten off the path. The only reason you know you're off the path is that a thought or an awareness has arisen, I'm off the path. Right? As soon as that has arisen, you know, get righteous back on. Don't, there's no recrimination, there's no nothing. Just get right back on. And you strengthen that muscle of practice. And you strengthen that muscle of impermanence. You strengthen that muscle of not seeing these things. You know, I know Alex takes a front at this because he thinks conditioning is this very powerful thing that only some kind of 20-foot giant, you know, could possibly break out of. But conditioning is simply conditioning. It's just another type of mental phenomena that is only powerful if you think it is. If you give it credence. If you just look at it, it disappears, right? You know, as soon as I see that I'm doing something because of my conditioning, I'm seeing that, right? And in that moment, right, Gunter, we have free will. In that moment, I can choose, because I see it, to do something different, right? In that moment, right? Up to that moment, I've been led by my conditioning because I've been unconscious. And so my conditioning is full. But as soon as I see that, and because I've been exposed to Buddha Dharma and I know something about how this mind works, I realize in that moment, I can do something different. And you've heard again, those of you who stuck around for all these years, you know, you've heard me say there is this wonderful saying in Dharma, practice begins with second thought. The first thought arises because of our conditioning. We can't help that one, right? But it's what do you do next? That's where practice begins. So that's, you know, it's keep it simple, Lee. Keep it simple, you know. Good. So you have been given tools over these past days of the essentials of right view. We haven't got into it. Those of you in intensive will have more opportunity to study these matters at our leisure, so to speak. But if you are sincerely trying to change your view from seeing everything as permanent to seeing everything as impermanent, and to see, as it said, that all phenomena carry the mark of impermanence, that means when you return to your life, everything you see, notice if it's marked with impermanence or permanence. Okay? So when you get on your Google News or you get on your whatever your source of news is, you are getting what? The latest news of impermanence. What has changed since I last read the news? Right? That's all you're getting. Right? That's what the news is about. They don't report things that stay the same. Right? They don't say, you know, headline, that large tree at the Franciscan Center is still there. Right? But if that tree blew down and fell on somebody, it would be reported. Right? So permanence is not reported in the news, impermanence is. So when you read the news, like I said, or when you read the obituaries, reflect on what you're reading. You know, things just keep changing. Right? One day the weather's like this, the next day there's a storm. One day it's hot, next day it's cold, right? Someday when somebody's alive, the next day they're dead. You know, one day there's peace in this country, the next day there's no peace. You know what I mean? It's like, right? Just in endless impermanence. Right? Every time you hear somebody's sick or somebody's, you know, talk about getting old or, you know, every time you hear somebody die, just say to yourself, all phenomena is marked with impermanence. When your thoughts arise, when your feelings arise, you know, and watch and notice and say to yourself, it's all impermanent. It's all changing. You know, yesterday I thought this person was the greatest person in the world. Today they're my worst enemy. I mean, you know, right? Impermanent. Right? My thoughts are impermanent. My views are impermanent. My ideas are impermanent. I used to think this politician was the great hope, you know, and now I think they're a disaster. You know, I mean, they haven't changed. What's changed? My perception, my ideas, always changing. Right? So please look at the mark of impermanence the same way, you know, as you see things, right? Remember the fish. The worm looks delicious. Notice all the things in your life that look delicious to you. Foods, sweets, things, all the things you want, all the things you think you need. And look and see, do they have the mark of impermanence? And is there something in my getting them that they could become a source of suffering to me? Everything has the potential of becoming a source of suffering, disappointment, trouble. Right? If you see that before, before you leap, you know, you may save yourself a lot of angst. If you see that everything has that mark. Most of the times we don't see it till afterwards. Wisdom is seeing it before. You see the mark of impermanence. just watch. Watch what goes on in the world. As you see people going after this and going after that, thinking that it'll bring them happiness. Look, are they happy? Not whether they say they're happy, but look at them. Do they look like happy people? Do they have smiles on their faces? Is their face at ease? Right? Are they happy? Do they seem to have a deep sense of well-being? I mean, that's happy. So it doesn't matter what people say. You know, how's everything? Everything's great. But look. Look deeply into life. What produces happiness and what produces affliction and unhappiness? And you'll see it. When you see things happening in life, look for causation. What causes? Don't be superficial. When you look for causation, you'll understand why things are unfolding the way they are. You won't be, unduly disturbed. You won't be unduly angry, enraged. You won't be fearful. You won't be disappointed because you'll understand clearly it cannot be any other way than it is. This person cannot be any other way than they are. The situation could not have arisen any other way because of causes and conditions. That is not a statement of a kind of moral or philosophical or moral acceptance. It is just a statement of philosophical acceptance. One understands why things are the way they are, and that brings peace. The mind is not only always disturbed and agitated because we are always upset and resisting by how life is unfolding. We do that because we are ignorant of how things really are and of the law of cause and effect. So please, as you enter the world again, look constantly for the signs of impermanence, the mistake of people believing things will cause them happiness and all it's bringing them is sorrow, and the same way understand that that it is the operating principle of the law of cause and effect, which is the silent motivator of all this seeming change in the world, inner and outer. As well as from time to time, don't forget to reflect on the preciousness of your life, the advantages and freedoms that we meditated on last night, that you have, that how rare and precious they are, but also we don't know the time limit on them. So please use reflecting on the preciousness of this life and the opportunities that are given to you right now, so you don't waste them, and that you know what is truly precious and what truly is not precious. And if you see that you are giving most of your time and energy to things that have little value and very little time to the things that have most value to you, you got to look at that. We all need to look at that. Are there any questions about future practice in terms of that? Then I want to talk about bodhisattvas. In listening to the and prostrating this morning, touching the earth, as we recited the names of the bodhisattvas, and thinking about how to practice when we return in the world, I realize we were already receiving that teaching this morning. All I need to do is bring our attention to it. Because each of these bodhisattvas, Manjusri, Samantabhadra, Avalokiteshvara, Maitreya, and there are many others that are not named here, Shakyamuni Buddha, they are all enlightened principles. They are all actions that come from our wisdom mind. And when we enumerate them and bow to them out of deep appreciation and respect, what we are doing are nurturing our awareness that those seeds lie within our own mind. Where did Manjusri get his wisdom? It wasn't from reading. It was only because he looked deeply into his own mind and observed life deeply in and around him that he saw clearly the truths of reality. It is that he gets his wisdom from. In the same way with Avalokiteshvara and Samanta Bhadra, they rely on the Buddha mind and the innate wisdom and compassion of the Buddha mind to fuel their activities. It does not come from reading and study. Most of us, even though we hear references that we all have this Buddha mind that is a repository of all wisdom and compassion, you know, all knowing and all this kind of these beautiful things, we don't get it, that those are referring to our own mind, that already our mind has that capacity in it. But because we are 100% reliant on our thinking mind, our conceptual mind, we think, oh, that's where it all is, right? I just gotta, you know, get my thoughts straight. Actually, it's not quite like that. It is our thoughts and our constant thinking about things that prevents us from just touching deeply this capacity our minds already have for complete understanding. And so by reciting and bowing to these principles, these beings, those are, should be reminders to us. Shakyamuni Buddha, teaching and living the way of awareness in the very midst of suffering and confusion. So, on an individual basis, each of us have our own suffering and confusion. Right? And the world, we might say, is made up of beings in which there is great suffering and confusion. Right? So it is clear from this statement that the place that we practice is where? In the very midst of suffering and confusion. That is where enlightenment will be found. We all know the references to the mud and the lotus, which is just another way of saying the same thing. So, in the very midst of suffering and confusion, living, if he's a Buddha, he's teaching, but we could say living the way of awareness. That's enough for us. Right. This is our challenge. Right. For most people, living in the midst of suffering and confusion only increases our suffering and confusion. Right. That is called the world is turning our dharma. In the very midst of suffering and confusion, we become more confused and we suffer more. Right? And then we come to retreat, get it together for a few days, and then we go out again, back to the world of suffering and confusion, and it just turns our Dharma upside down, that we are in the midst of suffering and confusion, suffering and confused. That is not the way of Shakyamuni Buddha. She lives the way of awareness in the very midst of suffering and confusion. Knowing that, that a human being like Shakyamuni Buddha, Siddhartha, you know, was able to live a life of awareness in the very midst of suffering and confusion should inspire us to do the same. But as long as you have the same view of as all the confused, if you're as confused as the confused people, and if you have the same causes of suffering that everybody else has, you know, they will turn you much quicker than you will turn them. But if in the midst of suffering and confusion, you have your clarity, you have your right view, you have your mindfulness, you have your bodhisattva way, you will not be turned. Because all the things that are turning people and confusing people and causing them suffering, either you have no interest for anymore, they are not interesting, they are not seductive, as well as all the concerns that cause people so much emotional anxiety, you know, have lost their attraction for you. You have already seen, you know, you've seen the hook. So the bait no longer interests you. You're more focused on what's important. But if you still are unclear, then you will find yourself constantly being hooked and pulled along. So we have the example of Shakyamuni Buddha, the awakened one, to whom we bow in gratitude, who lives the way of awareness in the very midst of suffering and confusion. Once you have mastered that capacity to live in the midst of suffering and confusion, beginning with your own and everybody else's, then you have something really to teach. Until that point, you are teaching something that you've heard or something that you believe in but is not your experience. And the best teachers are the ones who teach from their own experience. Cutting through ignorance, awakening our hearts and minds. That's quite beautiful. That's Manjusri. Manjusri, you know, is a bodhisattva of wisdom, carries the sword. Right? Or the sword that cuts in one, it is called. Cuts through ignorance, it cuts through duality. Restores things to their wholeness. It's kind of a magic sword. Typically, he is shown in one hand, he wields his wisdom sword. In his other hand, he has the Prajnaparamita Sutra. It is that wisdom that he uses to cut through ignorance. It's interesting that it says, cutting through ignorance, awakening our hearts and minds. See, we might misunderstand this verse. Right? We might think, first you cut through ignorance, and then, you know, he awakens our hearts and minds, or then I awaken my hearts and minds, right? You see what I'm saying? We think there's an and there. There's no and. There's a comma, but there probably shouldn't be a comma. There should be a, what's that thing called? That slant. Slash. There should, there's a slash. There should be a slash there. Because cutting through ignorance, the result of cutting through ignorance is the awakening of the heart-mind. The reason the heart-mind is not awake now is because it is covered with ignorance. When that ignorance, when that covering is taking off, the awakened heart-mind that we already have comes forward. It wants to come out. Many of us hear it calling us. The promptings of our heart. We hear it calling us. But we're too fearful. We're too preoccupied with our toys. We're too preoccupied with our egocentric concerns to listen and to hear it clearly and to follow it. But Manjusri shows us that we all have that capacity to cut through our ignorance with the sword of wisdom. And when that occurs, simultaneously, our hearts and minds awake. We all have that experience. Right? Even on a small scale, when you are caught up in some kind of delusive nonsense, and all of a sudden, some wisdom, some insight arises in you, and you free yourself of whatever it is you were involving yourself in, immediately your heart-mind feels better. Right? Immediately. Just, you didn't have to do anything. Just stop messing around. Manjusri, the great bodhisattva of great understanding. All of us have that capacity of great understanding. The teachings of the Buddhas, the teachings of the masters are simply skillful means to help us awaken what is already here. Shakyamuni Buddha, upon his great enlightenment, was dumbstruck, was awestruck that what he had been seeking all these years here and there and everywhere and all these practices and teachings and austerities and all this stuff and moving around and all, you know, he was amazed to find he had it all the time. He was just looking in the wrong direction. Awakening our hearts and minds. Please understand that's your heart, your mind. What is your heart mind? That which right now is listening to this talk. That is your heart mind. It is nowhere else. Next we have Samanta Bahadra, the Bodhisattva of great action. Samanta Bahadra is often shown iconographically, often he's on an elephant. Big, strong, right? Boom, boom. Solid, he's an elephant. He rides. In Asia, as a beast of burden, there was nothing better than an elephant. They were strong. When you needed some heavy lifting done, you got your elephant. Great with their trunks, great with pulling stuff, you know, pulling stuff down. He rides an elephant, Samanta Bahadra. So he's a hard worker, and he's strong. working mindfully, working joyfully for the sake of all beings. So if you want a prototype of, you know, how to be when you returned to your daily life, take Samanta Bhadra. You know, as you go about your day, be very mindful. Be very aware. And your prime concern is, can I bring benefit to people? You know, in every relationship, every encounter, there's always an opportunity to create some value, to bring some benefit. Even with strangers, just by making eye contact, by smiling, by saying, how are you? Or, you know, little things. One can create just a little bit, perhaps, of value in their life, or at least perhaps give them a sense that somebody was interested in them, somebody was caring how they were doing. But again, whatever we're doing, it may be the kind of work that doesn't obviously, you know, you're not directly helping another human being one-to-one, but whatever work you do, to work with it with the intention that this will bring benefit to somebody, that people will benefit from whatever this activity is I'm doing. When one has the intention to do good, one has the wish that whatever one is doing will bring benefit to others, that will make you happy. You don't have to, it's not like you got to manufacture happiness. And that will make you happy. As the great master Shanti Deva said, he says, all the happiness of the world comes from aiding beings, helping beings. All the suffering of the world comes from thinking only of yourself. And that is what Shanti Deva said. So working mindfully, working joyfully for the sake of all beings. You know, there are some people who think practice is heavy duty. Practice is serious. You know, perhaps, you know, listening to teachings on impermanence and suffering, cause and effect, one might not find a big, broad smile coming to one's face. And yet you will find, you know, when you meet great teachers, great bodhisattvas who are in this world, like Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, many others, you'll find that they seem to be happy people who smile easily. It is because their motivation for practice comes from their deep understanding of impermanence, cause and effect, the suffering of human existence. They have gotten that to the point that they don't need that constant motivation. It's always in their face because they're always dealing with people, and so they're always dealing with the suffering of the human condition. But because they know they have an opportunity to be of help, to be of service, and to bring benefit to people, they're happy. As well as people like that know how to nourish themselves with the beautiful things in life. They don't spend a lot of time dwelling in negative mind states, negative emotions, etc. But they cultivate a whole set of positive interactions which bring forth positive emotions. Caring, love, things like that make one happy. Not having a mind burdened down by concerns and stress and pressures, you know, one has a heavy mind, there's a heaviness and all that. But if one doesn't have like a mind like that, has a much freer mind, and then the mind is much lighter. It's at ease, and it smiles more easily, like a child does. So we have Shakyamuni teaching, living the way of awareness in the midst of suffering. We have Manjusri, cutting through ignorance, awakening hearts and minds. We have Samanta Bahadra, working mindfully, joyfully for the sake of all beings. And then we have our old friend Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, responding to suffering, serving beings in countless ways. You notice all the bodhisattvas kind of have their special job description. They're like specialists. It's like, you know, going in the hospital, and sometimes you see, you know, your generalist like Shakyamuni, he takes care of most things. But some people need a little extra, you know, let's call for Manjusri. We really have an ignoramus down here. We don't. So anyhow, Avalokiteshvara's specialty is responding to suffering people. That is that's what it's about. You know, Avalokiteshvara means the one who hears the cries of the world. Originally, you know, Buddhist iconography, most of the bodhisattvas were male. It was interesting over time in the Mahayana countries that Avalokiteshvara became a female. You know, you'll see Kuan Yin in China, Canon, and it's interesting because obviously somewhere along the line it seemed like hearing the sufferings of the world or something was more in line with women than men. I mean, it's probably too bad, I mean, that it happened, but somewhere along the line it's interesting that Avalokiteshvara became a female, but we know both men and women have this capacity. When we are living in our own egocentric bubble, when our modus operandi in the world is narcissism, we are primarily only concerned about ourself and see ourself reflected in everything, we will not hear the cries of the world. And we won't even notice anybody else's suffering. If we notice anybody's suffering that raises great concern with us, it's our own. And our concern doesn't go much beyond that. You know, for some people who come out of their narcissistic bubble, they might be concerned for their family members, close family members, things like that. You know, some people kind of come a little more out, and they may, you know, extend it to extended family, friends. You know, I mean, people, you know, people come out further. They may, some of their neighbors. They may include, you know, some people, people who go to their church, you know what I'm saying, or maybe people of their own ethnic group, you know, people, it's interesting. But Avalokiteshvara has no boundaries. It understands the commonality of all beings, all human beings. We are of one family. We enter our, and so Avalokiteshvara is touched by all sufferings, does not discriminate. But I was talking to somebody yesterday, they were talking about suffering and wanting to help. And I said, as often said in the teachings, that a bodhisattva is like an armless mother whose child has fallen into the river. The child is being swept along by the current, but the mother has no arms. She cannot help. All she can do is run along the bank, sad, calling out to her child. So in a certain way, it's like that. But yet, we remember Samanta Baharja, and we realize, even though there is this immense suffering going on everywhere in this Saha world, in my own universe, in my own location, there are people who I can be of benefit to. And so that impulse to alleviate the suffering of another, the suffering of everyone, is manifested in responding to suffering in, as it says here, serving beings in countless ways. There are many types of sufferings, and there are many ways to relieve people's sufferings. We can be creative. But we have to, it is said in Dharma, our aspiration can be boundless. I mean, we can aspire to relieve the suffering of the world. We can aspire to benefit everyone. But we have to remember that when we say things like that, that includes everybody, which includes yourself, the people you live with, your family, you know, everybody. So you can have a vast mind of aspiration, but yet in the actuality, please apply it very locally. You know, many people have great vows, but they don't actualize it. So Avalokiteshvara, Samanta Bahadra, Manjusri, Shakyamuni, they're working. They're working. And then, what are we doing here today? It's 11 o'clock. What is the schedule?
11:30
and then lunch is when?
Yeah, it says 12:15, but they don't usually serve till 12:30.
Right, and we always run over, don't we? Yes. So we'll just go for a few minutes more, and we'll take a break. Seed of awakening, loving kindness, and children sprouts and all being. Maitreya, the Buddha to be born. In kind of Buddhist cosmology, remember we talked yesterday about Buddhas appearing in world systems and how Shakyamuni is our Buddha, and he appeared 2,600 years ago. But in Buddhist cosmology, things kind of run down over time. And as the age goes on, the energy kind of peters out, and it's time for what do they call it in baseball? You bring in your relief pitcher or something. your closer is up there, right? So it's good to know that even as we speak here in Tushita Heaven, Maitreya, who's already a full Buddha, fully enlightened, done all the work, right? He's there, waiting to be called. He's like the relief pitcher. He's waiting. He's in the bullpen. He's warming up. And he's up there very interestingly. Iconography, he's often shown like this. He's in an interesting pose. See, he's not locked in like in the meditation pose. Anybody's ever kind of sat a long time in the lotus postures, you know, you can't just kind of jump right out of it, kind of thing. It's hard to be ready, right? So Maitreya, he's like this. His legs aren't locked in, and he's like this. You see, it's an interesting pose. What he's doing, he's contemplating sentient beings, and he's just up there devising all kinds of skillful ways to benefit us. Right. So he's kind of studying us right now from afar, you know, watching us do our stuff. And then thinking, you know, how can I help these people? You know, what kind of tricks can I have up my sleeve, you know, to get them to pay attention? Right? So that's, just want to let you know that don't despair. There is a relief pitcher. If things get too, if we fall too far behind, the forces of delusion. But in this, so he's Maitreya, the Buddha to be born. But I think where this verse is touching is a kind of less the cosmological understanding of Maitreya, but more the deeper understanding that the potential for awakening and Buddhahood is imminent already in us. Seed of awakening, Thay called it. Seed of awakening and loving kindness. In children sprouts in all being. He begins with children and sprouts, I think, because it's more obvious. Right. Often in young children, you see that natural good-heartedness. And sprouts, obviously, very clearly, in a sprout of a plant, we see the potential for growth and development manifesting. So Maitreya is, in this sense, is the seed, the sprout within all of us. We all, no matter what you think, everybody has those seeds. Seeds of awakening, seeds of kindness, seeds of openness, seeds of fearlessness, seeds of intelligence, seeds of wisdom, seeds of patience, seeds of mindfulness, right? Seeds of understanding. Everybody has those seeds. Everybody has those potential sprouts. And it's important that as we return to our life, we understand, you know, it's funny, kind of traditional Buddhists in Asia, they have like, I guess there's something like chants or, you know, come Maitreya, come. They actually have sort of prayers like that. You know, very much, you know, like in the Christian and other tradition, you know, come Maitreya, come. Come to this world. We need a Buddha, right? Like that. Come turn the wheel of Dharma. But I think the way it's presented here is much more meaningful. The truth is, only human beings will save this world from human beings. It is up to each of us to awaken those dormant seeds of enlightened living, altruistic thinking, open-heartedness, interdependence, interbeing. It's up to each of us to, you know, really very consciously cultivate those seeds in us so they can really grow and sprout in this world system. So again, please, if you do the practice of touching the earth, or if you just read it, please understand that in the recitation of these qualities and characteristics of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, We are enumerating our own qualities of our own heart, mind, and the potential for all of us to act that way in the world. And then one final quote. This is from Words of My Perfect Teacher, again, which is one of the texts along with Thich Nhat Hanh's The Heart of Perfect the Buddhist Teaching, which we'll be using in the upcoming intensive. In his section on arousing bodhicitta, Pachar Rinpoche writes, this is sort of advice to people. He says, always take the lowest place, wear simple clothes, help all other beings as much as you can. In everything you do, simply work at developing love and compassion until they have become a fundamental part of you. That will serve the purpose. Even if you do not practice the more outward and conspicuous forms of Dharma, such as prayers, virtuous activity, and altruistic works. And then he quotes the sutra that perfectly encapsulates the Dharma. And he quotes it, there's this quote that says, let those who desire Buddhahood not train in many Dharmas, but only one. Which one? Great compassion. Those with great compassion possess all the Buddha's teaching as if it were in the palm of their hand. Is that clear? Let me read it again. In the sutra that perfectly encapsulates the Dharma, it is said, let those who desire Buddhahood not train in many Dharmas, but only one. Which one? Great compassion. Those with great compassion possess all the Buddha's teaching as if it were in the palm of their hand. Good advice. Keep our eye on the essentials. You clear, Brian? Good.